today's shear. So we have two things, lahavdil. One is that Mark Chipkin has yahrzeit for his father, which is a little shocking that it's been a whole year. The Torah we learned should be for Ilui Nishmas ben Tzion ben Zev Avram Halevi, and Lahavdil ben Chaim Lachaim, that should be for Shlema to Fradel bat Gittel besoch Shar Chole Yisrael, that everybody who needs a refuah should have a refuah, and as they say, Yeshua Hashem Keherif Ayin, that just as things can go very bad dramatically in a moment, things can also dramatically get fixed and healed, and all kinds of yeshuot that sometimes we can't even imagine take place immediately. So Be'ezrat Hashem. Okay, so as I said, we'll get through the preliminaries, and now my father has entered as well. So now you give me permission to begin. And sometimes you say something which is completely different, and sometimes the same, or the similarity. So some of the things I'm going to say today, I think for some of you should be, I'm not going to say familiar, but it will sound like it rings a bell. I'm not going to say necessarily a Pavlovian bell, but it rings some kind of a bell. But there are some wrinkles, and I'm going to say significant wrinkles that I don't think I've said before. My big disadvantage is I don't listen to all the old shiurim, so I don't know what it is that I've said in the past. It's just I'm relying on my memory. So let us begin. So we're going to start on this week's parsha. We're going to move backwards. We're going to move forwards. We're going to do lots of movement. And we're really going to deal primarily with the beginning of the parsha, something hopefully before we finish towards the moving on in the parsha. But let's begin. V'deber Shem Moshe l'mor, Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aharon HaKohen hishiv et chamati me'al b'nei Yisrael b'kanot k'nati b'tocham v'lo kiliti b'nei Yisrael b'kanati. So Pinchas somehow did something. I'm going to say somehow, that's we remember from last week. He caused God not to be angry, and he caused Am Yisrael to be saved. He stopped the Magefa, which means something which we're familiar that Aaron had done in the past when there was anger and there was a Magefa which came into the camp, and Aaron somehow had stopped it. So now we find that Pinchas had really done the same thing. The Chain, Emor hini noten lo et briti shalom, I'm giving him this covenant of shalom, of peace. Vaitalo ulazaro charev brit kunat olam. There's an argument about that, this covenant of being a Kohen forever. Was he a Kohen? Was he not a Kohen? It's very complicated, the whole argument that he was not a Kohen. His father was a Kohen. His grandfather was a Kohen. Nonetheless, some go in that direction. Tachat asher kinei lelokav v'chaper al b'nei Yisrael. Some say actually that what he received is that to become the Kohen Gadol will come out of his family. Then the Torah gives us a little bit more information that we were not aware of last time, and it tells us the identities of the protagonists. V'shem ish Yisrael ha-mukeh, asher huka et ha-midyanit, Zimri ben Salu, nesi beit av l'shemoni, v'shem ha-isha ha-mukeh ha-midyanit, kazbi batzor rosh umat beit av b'midyanhu. So we're now given the identities, Zimri, Kozbi, I know everybody's very tempted to say something about Kozbi this week, and I will refrain. But Schut Kozbi, there's all kinds of Yeshuot as well, which is probably incredibly disturbing. It continues, well, will continue by then moving backwards, because last week we met, again, the protagonists, and we were just told Ish mibnei Yisrael et hamidyanit, which means it was one of these parshia which sound like it was deliberately said in a way whereby leaving really important information, because you know it could have filled in that information as well then, but rather it was presented us in this particular way, and then it ends, of course, Vatzar hamagefa mi'al b'nei Yisrael, the plague stopped. But let's go back to the beginning, because there is some confusion here, and it's really the confusion that I want to point out, and I want to stay with the rest of today. V'yeshev Yisrael b'shitim v'yechel ha'am liznot el benot Moav. And Israel was in Shittim, and they began to, however you want to translate the word znot, they began to act in an inappropriate manner with the daughters of Moab. Now, the confusion that I want to address is the confusion which has gone all the way through, we'll look at it more specifically soon, is the relationship between Moab and Midian, which means we're told in the beginning that the Jewish men begin to act inappropriately with the daughters of Moab. Now, those of us who know about Moab, that should be of no surprise whatsoever, and we're going to come back to that as well. And afterwards, we're told that there is a woman, and she is this woman who is this Midianite. And over here, again, it gets clarified, and we're told she's not just any Midianite. She is Kozi Batsur Rosh Umot Beit Av Midianu. Her family is a very important family in Midian. But of course, what's more concerning is, like, it's almost like make up your mind. Which one is it? Is it Moab or is it Midian? What exactly is this interrelationship? Why is somebody from Midian there if this was mainly, we're told in the introduction, this was a Moab enterprise? On top of all that, I also want to throw out a question which could be a little bit annoying. I know the way that we read this, and we read it in the way that I'm about to tell you because of ways of reading some other events which will take place subsequently, but none of it is actually ironclad. So let me explain to you what I mean. The Benot Moab who came and befriended the Jewish boys, was this part of what we can call a nefarious, premeditated plan in order to try to kill as many Jewish men as possible, to debase and cause the deaths of, which means, was this actually, at the end of the day, mission accomplished? And we go from Pasuk Aleph to Pasuk Bet. Vatikra'ena la'am lezivchei Eloheihim, and they called them to come and to serve their gods. V'yochal la'am v'yishtachavu l'Eloheihim, and the people did, which means we have over here a situation which very, very quickly deteriorates. If you want to speak in terms of what we call sometimes the three cardinal sins in Judaism, Gilui Arayot, Shfichat Damim, Avodah Zarah, look at this, within nine verses we get all three of them taking place. We have blood which is being spilled, we have idolatry, and we have sexual sins taking place. So my question really is, regarding the daughters of Moab, is this part of the plan? And I can build up the plan. And not only can I build up the plan, let's work backwards a little bit. One of the things we're going to find later on is that even though he was sent away, and even though presumably he went home, during the war that will follow, the war against Midian, we suddenly find Bilam there. And what in the world is Bilam doing there? And the commentaries ask, why is Bilam there? And the Midrashim ask, why is Bilam there? And they give a really simple answer. Oh, you know why Bilam's there? Bilam is there because he finally achieved what he was hired to do. 24,000 Jews were killed, and he says, okay, it's payment time. Now, of course, you can ask yourself a question, what in the world does Bilam have to do with the Benot Moab, and for that matter, for this young woman from Midian? What does one thing have to do with the other? So, again, I can use my Midrashic imagination and then say that part of what he prophesied, or what he saw through his prophetic eye, was Ma Tovu Alecha Yaakov, how beautiful the tents are. And we know that Chazal tell us, look how the tents are built, not like many Jewish neighborhoods in Jerusalem, where no window looked in another window. That's part of what Chazal say. There were some ultra-Orthodox neighborhoods that they don't have televisions. They don't need televisions. They can each look into everyone else's bedroom. So of course they don't need televisions in those places. It's really quite horrific. Honestly, how some of these places were built. They were built because of nobody followed building codes, but we'll leave that because that can obviously lead to much worse things. And over here, I could then argue that what Bilam actually had said is, look how chaste they are, look how modest they are, look how they live in such, you know, a place, and therefore they say, oh, that's the way to undermine them, is by going and by bringing in Avodah Zarah and Gilui Arayot. Now, I'm not exactly sure why I needed a Bilam to tell them this, but who knows. then I can say that this was this plan. And I really do think that that is part of the way that we prefer to look at it. But I want you to recognize that there is another possibility. The other possibility is that they're terrified of these people. And again, I don't want to confuse between Moav and Midian, because we will as we go onwards. Moav is terrified of Bnei Yisrael. And at some point they say, hold it a second, let's just change tactics, or not even tactics, let's change strategy. If we can't beat them, let's join them. If these people were afraid that they're going to capture us, they're afraid they're going to do terrible things to us, let's befriend them. Let's go and become friendly with them. And therefore, there was nothing on the part of Moav which was looking to harm them in any way. Again, you know, growing up in Brooklyn, there were always two types of non-Jews. One type who were anti-Semitic and hated us and did all kinds of hate crimes. And the other kind was the ones that liked us and, you know, told their daughters to marry Jewish kids and so on. So now you tell me which one Jewish parents were more afraid of. Were they more afraid of the non-Jews who hated us, or were they more afraid of the non-Jews who liked us? And I think we all know the answer to that. That meaning, if you understand this now, you understand everything about Judaism you need to understand. I mean, that's basically the whole thing, is that it's frightening either way. But even though we would normally look at, yes, Bilaam came to collect his wages because it was his idea and so on, except for one thing, who said it was? Bilaam may have been killed because he never got that far. Maybe his donkey was mad at him and wasn't driving so quickly. I mean, I can... all kinds of reasons why he was still around and not gotten away yet. So if we now move a little bit further, and I just want to crystallize the question. This is primarily an operation which is done by Benot Moav. We don't know if they're sent because this is an act of war and this is a new tactic that they're using, or it's a changed strategy, and now they decided to be friendly with them. So we don't know how to read this, but nonetheless, what is this significant Midianite woman doing when it's essentially a Moav story? So if we go backwards a little bit more, and the end of Parshat Chukat, which means we're going back 2 weeks, there's another issue which is really the background for the whole story, and that's the Emori. The Emori, as we see, Vayishlach Yisro Melachim El Sichon Melech Emori Lemor, send messengers, can we pass through? And they say no, and they come out, Vayilachem Yisrael, and they came out, and a war ensued. But what happened? We were victorious. Vayirashet Artso Me'arnon Ad Yabok, O B'nei Amon, Ki Az Gvul B'nei Amon, Vayikach Yisrael At Kol Ha'arim Ha'ele, that Israel took all of their cities, Vayesh Yisro B'chol Arei Emori. And then it specifically speaks about Cheshbon. Ki Cheshbon ir Sichon melech Amorihi, v'hu nilcham b'melech Moav harishon, v'yikach et kol artzo miyado ad Arnon. That, you know, going back to Middle Eastern ancient history, that borders change, governments change. Who is in charge of a piece of land or a parcel of land today did not necessarily own it 10 years ago or 20 years ago, and so on. But what happened is that the Jews had taken land which would belong to the Emori, and we're going to keep the Emori in mind as well. Now we've got the Moabites, and we have the Midianites, and now we have the Emori, the Emorites as well, and they have Moab land. So that's part of the problem here. And then we have a little of a, we can call a poetic interlude over here, which we're going to skip. Oylecha Moav avadata am kamush natan banav pleitim v'natav b'shvit lemelech Emori Sichon. So, v'yeshev Yisrael be'eretz Emori. So we sat in the land of the Emori, but the problem with the land of Emori is that some of it historically had once been belonged to Moab. And of course we know the other rule of the Middle East is that other people can get along with one another, but once the Jews take somebody's land, then suddenly we need to give it back and have a two-state solution or so on. And then it ends with, remarkably, I'm not sure why it's, well, I guess we can figure out why it is a new chapter. Now it's Pasuk Aleph, the Yisubin Israel, v'yachanu barvot Moab, And that's part of why Moab was so scared, because the Jews had taken their land. Not just scared, that's probably why they're so upset, because now they've captured their land. Of course, they've captured their land because the Amori refused to be peaceful, which means, I guess, the lesson one could have learned over here is be peaceful with these people, and then we're not going to run into any kinds of problems. I'm just pointing out that later on, getting way ahead of ourselves, what ends up happening to the land of the Amori is Yehu b'nei Machir ben Menashe, and he ends up taking this land. And keep that in mind, because what we have over here is that it ends up going to somebody, Menashe, somebody from Yosef. Now, one of the reasons why you should keep that in mind is that this seems to have been a promise going way back. In source number 5, we have Ayom Yisrael al Yosef, and this is Yaakov is elderly, and he calls Yosef in, Hine Nochimet. The day is going to come that you're going to go back to the land, which, again, we're getting right up to that point. In other words, Shechem here, we don't know what it means. Doesn't mean Shechem, because the tribe of Yosef does get Shechem. But the word Shechem over here doesn't really mean the place of Shechem. It means I've given you an extra slice. This extra piece of land that I'm taking away from the Emori, I'm giving to you. So now you notice the Emori involved in the story, and you notice it going to Yosef, and then you see that Machir ben Menashe is taking the extra piece of land. So I'm not necessarily telling you that I'm dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's. I'm just showing you that there is, you know, a theme over here that probably needs to be more explored, but the Emori go back with us a little bit further. When the Brit Bein HaPatarim, when the covenant is forged between God and Avram, he also says at which point we're coming back, source 6, it's when the sin of the Emori becomes too great. It's at that point you're going to be going into the land and taking the land, and of course taking what belongs to the Emori as well. And everything I just now said is complicated, and I've oversimplified dramatically. Nonetheless, go with the flow. Last week's parsha then begins with all the history I just now gave you. Again, even though it was really in broad strokes, Vayar Balak ben Zippor et kol asher asa Yisrael Amori. Balak sees everything that was done to the Amori. Now, it's also interesting in terms of the lack of identity. It's not the same as what we had when we started this week's parsha, where we ended last week not knowing the identity, and then we're given the identity. Over here, we're giving it a partial identity. Balak ben Zippor. Now, there's one really important element about who he is, which we're not told yet, and that we're told in a couple verses down, but that is, of course, that he's king. And normally, when a king is introduced into a narrative, especially if it's important that he's king, we should have been told right away. Vayar Balak ben Zippor, Melech Lemoav, or Melech Moav, should have been told right away, and it's not. Which actually tells Chazal that there's even more intrigue over here, which means he was not king. But let's read a little bit more. V'yagarmo av b'nei ha'amaod ki rav hu, and we have this fright and this disgust. V'yakatzmo av b'nei Yisrael, and all of the background. But again, look at the starting point. The starting point is the Emori. The starting point is that we took that land, and which means this is going to become a focal point within the narrative which is taking place, and ultimately it's going to help forge the federation or the confederation between Moab and Midian, which is part of what we're trying to get back to. In Pasuk Dalet over here, it says, Vayomer Moav el Ziknei Midian. So now you have Moav and Midian. Of course, we don't know who in Moav and who in Midian are doing the speaking. Given really beautiful anti-Semitic tropes in terms of the Jews as animals and coming and swallowing everything in front of them. Goebbels would have been proud of this description. And then it comes back and tells us, Ubalak ben Zippor melech Moav beitahi, and Balak was king at that point, which has led Chazal to tell us, which means he was not king before. Matter of fact, although in Pasuk Bet he may not have been king, it could have been that his whole campaign slogan and the way that he got chosen, selected, coronated, was he used this as the battle cry. Look what the Jews have done, and they've taken our land, right? Our land. Although there's something which is fascinating, the Targum Yonatan, and that is, or the Pseudo Yonatan, and that's in source 8 and 9. We can look at it in either one. I suspect we prefer the Hebrew, and it's bolded here. Ubalak ben Zippor Hamidyani Melech Lemoav Be'etahi. It just gave us an extra piece of identity regarding Balak. He wasn't even from Moab. He was from Midian. Which means when I said before that we have this Moab-Midian confusion, I hope the confusion just now was raised a notch or two, because we don't know. I'm working backwards now. We have the girls from Moab come, and then suddenly from Midian shows up. We have over here Moab being concerned because they lost their land. They lost their land to the Amori, who now they've lost that land in turn to Israel. And the truth is they have no claim against Israel because Israel didn't take it from them. They took it from, which means now it's really lost. And this becomes the battle cry. But the person who's the instigator, who is causing the battle cry, is not even somebody who's from Moab at all. He is somebody, I mean, again, Hitler wasn't from Germany. So it's really interesting that he was not from Moab. He's from Midian, and he feels this historical wrong which has taken place, and he then uses this historical wrong in order to catapult himself and to end up becoming king of Moab, even though he's not from Moab at all. So what I really want us to focus then on and to think about a little bit is this characteristic, again, of an individual, and maybe we shouldn't go any further than that, one individual who's from Midian, who suddenly finds himself in a situation that he really has nothing to do with, and now before you know it, he becomes the focal point of this situation, and he uses some manipulation, he uses some arguments, and he starts, you know, uses some type of patriotism, and next thing you know, he is the king of Moab. And all of this, I think should be fascinating, and perhaps another manifestation of the same thing is when we find in the beginning of the Parsha, where we started today in Pinchas, we find suddenly this Midianite important woman. Of course, we can ask ourselves, okay, and where did she come from before? Where did her father come from before? But what is this Midian woman doing over here in the middle of this Moab either strategy or tactic? Either they change the strategy or they're using different tactics. What's she doing here in the middle of it? But essentially, that kind of question, that's the wrinkle that I was talking about in the very beginning. Why does Midian show up in certain situations that we weren't expecting them to show up? What's going on here with that? The Midrash, which is really Rashi, is taken from the Midrash, and we can choose to look at 10 or 11. Rashi in 10 does point out that lo ya ra'uy l'malchut, he was not minischei Midyan haya. Again, he points out what we saw in that Targum, that he really wasn't of the royal family lineage or had rights to the kingdom in Moab, because he was one of the princes of Midian, which, by the way, then does create a direct parallel with Cozbi, who is from one of the princes of Midian, and again, somehow is involved in some place they shouldn't be. What's added in, Kivin Shemait Sichon, Mino Aleim Letzorech Sha'ah. And again, it's the Sichon death with Emori, which then suddenly he becomes necessary, or he makes himself necessary. The Midrash does claim one more thing, is why they would have turned to Midian, which I'm just pointing out that I've been selling this in the opposite way. Not that they turned to Midian, that Midian actually created the manipulation. It's actually Balak who creates this whole manipulation, but the Midrash says something which I find fascinating. And it says that they went to investigate because they knew that Moshe used to live there. So what is the power of Moshe? And they're told it's Ein Kocho Ela Bifiv. It's Moshe's great speaking ability. Now that should actually, I don't know if it's comical or if it's sad. I mean, that's essentially what Moshe's disability is. Moshe's disability is in terms of speaking. No, that's really where his power is. So that therefore they need to find somebody else who can speak. So again, that really is interesting that that's the conclusion. And one suspects that it's more focused on trying to explain why they go for Bilam than really telling us something significant about Moshe. But I do want to ask one more haunting question. Who gave them the information? Was it the neighbors? Was it, you know, the guy who worked in the gas station, the guy from the local bar or be'er, as the case may be? Which means, who gave them this information? And then the haunting part of it is, well, was it Yitro? Was it Reuel? Was it Chovev? I know there's another four names. Is Moshe's family, meaning Moshe's family is from Midian. Moshe's wife is from Midian. Moshe is known by the people. So who in Midian is giving this information? And I obviously don't know the answer to that. What the Midrash then points out, you know, furthermore, and again, this is also said in the very beginning of Rashi. We can look at it in either one. Rashi says they went to Zikne Midian. Halomei Alomim Sonim Zedze. They hated one another. Shenemar Hamaket Midian Bistei Moav. We'll perhaps look at that as well. But rather, Elam Yiratan Sheisar Lasu Shalom Beinehem. The Jews will ultimately bring world peace. I mean, this is what it says, that the people who hate us, we are able to bring people that hate one another together. We've done this many times, and therefore we can create all kinds of peace, which is really quite tragic and sad, but it says that that's the point. They did not get along with one another at all. So let's now try to move further to try to understand the underpinnings of this and what were Benot Moav doing there. The truth is, it's of no surprise whatsoever. And I want to say it with really a two-step, not just a one-step, a two-step in this. Going back to Perek Yudtet is where we're going to meet Moav, because that's where Moav makes their appearance. Moav, of course, is the illegitimate son of Lot and Lot's daughters. There's a funny thing, which if you read Shtai Mikra Echot Targum, you notice it. And, you know, I see it every year. See, I see Lot in Parshat Balak. The reason I see Lot is because he's all over the place. Now, you're saying, what are you talking about, Lot's all over the place? So maybe you're thinking, I'm saying, oh, by extension, Lot's there because Moav comes from Lot, and Lot is there. But there's another point. I'm just going to show you one indication of it, but there are dozens, that when, if you look at Source 13, Vayichar af Balak el Balam, Vizbaru kapav, Vayomer Balak el Balam, Lakov Avai, I want you to curse them. In Aramaic, the word for cursing is the same root as Lot, Limilat. There's lots of different forms of it. But, I would assume that Lot gets his name because he's the one who escapes. He escapes from stone. So, of course, you're going to say, but why is he called that beforehand? I think that nonetheless, we find that sometimes in Tanakh, the biblical characters, because of a very, really important episode, that they get their name even though they're called it before. But that's because that's the way the story is told. Lot is the one who escapes from stone, and therefore he's Lot, Shenimlat. And you can actually see that connection. What I'm saying now is certainly not pshat. As I just said, it's something which we notice, and therefore we can't ignore it. But all through last week's parsha, every time it uses the word curse, and you look at the Aramaic, you do Yishtai Mikra Echot Targum, and suddenly Lot is staring at you. Now, Lot is this tragic character who tries, I think he tries to do good. He has his guests that are coming. And, of course, all of the neighbors in Sodom are not that happy with this. And they go and they surround the house. We're back in Source 12. Pasuk Vav, Vayetze Aleim Lot, Apetcha, Vadelot Sagar Charav. And then, what is it that he says? Hineina li shtei banot asher lo yadu ish, otziana ethen aleichem, vasulem kitov beinechem. Lot is willing to sacrifice his daughters for an ideology, for gain, in order, in this case, what he believes to be quite important to protect his guests. But nonetheless, you do have to ask yourself a question. So how exactly do the daughters feel? Oh, dad is willing to hand us over. He's willing to, I don't know how bad language you want me to use, he's willing to pimp us out in order to that he can entertain his guests. I mean, I would assume that there is something really quite disturbing about this, but that's why I'm saying that there was stages or two steps to this. What the Benot Lot end up doing afterwards, when they end up getting their father drunk and seducing their father and then bearing each of them a child from their father, Moav, and afterwards Ammon, that should not be a surprise to people who were brought up in this cursed house of Lot, whereby they learn that you're able to do things which are sexually inappropriate because of personal gain, because that's what they learned from their father. Which means when we get to the end of last week's parsha, and we find Benot Moav over there, that is not such a surprise to us, because that's the way that Benot Moav behaves. So I'm saying that part was somewhat, I'd even say almost predictable. On the other hand, with Midian, those of us who forget, you know, I always remind you that Midian is the son of Avraham and Keturah. And Midian, therefore, as a son of Avraham, but a son of Avraham who's rejected, that also creates some, I would say, interesting psychological self-definition. I have incredible importance because I'm Avram's son, but on the other hand, I know that I'm inadequate because I'm not the son of Avram who was chosen. So there is going to be a very interesting dynamic over there, but that is who Midian is. Towards the end of Perek Lamed Vav, where the kings are introduced, and do realize that a lot of what we've been talking about today, that's been under the surface, because we have this princess who has appeared from Midian. We have this man, Balak, who becomes the Melech, the king of Moab. And just to adding into our whole kingship issue, and keep that in mind, because it's going to be another strand that, if we have time, we'll tie up as well, or at least point at. In Perek Lamed Vav, we're told, Ve'elah ha-malachim ha-shem malchu be'edom, here are the kings who ruled in Edom, lefnei melach, malach melech lefnei Yisrael. There's also somebody who sounds almost quite familiar, Ve'emloch be'edom, Bela ben Ba'or. He sounds almost like somebody who we met last week, but it just seems to be coincidence. And we're told there's lots of kings come from different places. V'shem Iro din Hava. And then we're told somebody else who comes, Mi Batsra. And then with somebody else who comes, Me'eretz HaTemani. And then finally we have in Pasuk Lamed Hey, we have Hamakeh et Midian b'stei Moav v'shem Iro Avit. And that is this battle that took place between Midian and Moav, which was referenced here. Don't they hate one another? Don't Midian and Moav not get along with one another? So they made peace. Why do they make peace? Because we, as I said before, bring people together. So now, another episode where Midian suddenly shows up in the middle of the story that has nothing to do with them. And that's going to be disturbing again. Of course, what I'm talking about is the Mechirat Yosef, source 17. Vayhi kasher ba Yosef el achav, v'yafshitu et Yosef. They rip off et ketonato, et ketonat abasim asher lav. They rip off his coat of many colors. Vayikhu vayishlichu oto habora v'borekin b'mayim. They throw him off into the pit without water. V'yeshvu lecho lechem. They sit v'yesu ineim, and then they lift up their eyes. V'yiru v'hinei arachat yishme'ilim ba'am migilad. By the way, Gilad also should be something which you should have paid attention to as well, where exactly Gilad is, but it is also part of this whole story. If you missed it, okay. The yishme'ilim are coming from Gilad, and it tells us all the things that are there, and they're on their way to Egypt. Yehuda then makes his proclamation, what do we gain from selling our brother, after all, and covering up his blood? After all, he's our brother. Now, the stated plan of Yehuda is to sell him to the Ishmaelim, because that's who he sees. And they agree, they listen, which would then very much sound like that's what they then do. Therefore, they obey. Yishmu is not just listen, it's they obey. And that's the problem. What in the world are the Midianim doing over here? So again, what I want to point out is that Midian shows up in a place they're not supposed to be. Midianim socharim. Now, no one knows how to read these verses. I mean, it could be you knew how before I started, but we don't know how to read these verses, because they're not simple. I mean, if I read it as I just now read it, Vayishma'u Echav, and his brothers obeyed, then Vayavru Anashim Midyanim, which I don't know why it's being told, Socharim, and then they're passing by, Vayimshechu, Vayaleyu et Yosef Minabor, Vimkuru et Yosef Liyishma'ilim. The problem is, who did that? Because if I read Pasuk Kavchet without Vayishma'u Echav, Vayavru Anashim Midyanim Socharim, and Midyanim came by, Vayim Shechu, the Midyanim lifted him out, Vayalu et Yosef, they're the ones who took him out of the pit Minabor, Vayim Karu et Yosef Lishmaelim Besrim Kasef, and the Midyanim, the ones who sold him, Vayaviyu et Yosef Mitzrayma, and they brought Yosef to Egypt. So who's they? So we're not even sure about that, by the way, because you look at the end of the chapter, Vamidyanim, or Midanim, Machru, Oto el Mitzrayim lepotifar sris paro sarat habachim. And by the way, just to make sure that that's also sufficiently complicated, you say, hold on, Midyan or Madan, if you go back and you look at source 15, Pasuk Bet, that Keturah and Avram have some kids, which, by the way, was probably pretty complicated at home. Whose laundry is this? Is this Madan's or Midyan's? But you have over here that Yosef is sold, and he sold Hamidanim. So the Midyanim is the same as Midyan. And now, by this point, we're completely confused, especially you get to the Pasuk Aleph in Perek Lamitet. V'Yosef Horad Mitzrayim, V'Yikneu Potifar, Sris Paro, Sara Tabachim, Ish Mitzrim, Yadi Yishmaelim, Asher Haridu Shama. Now, how in the world do you reconcile all of this? One approach is to say he was sold many, many times. The Midyanim to the Ishmaelim to the Midyanim back to the Ishmaelim, and he was sold many times. Why was Yosef sold many times? Well, because we have a problem with the verse. There are those, however, who would prefer to say that, no, that's all the same people. Look at the Ibn Ezra in 19. Ki Midyanim yikru Ishmaelim v'chinam al malchei Midyan ki Ishmaelim heim. That they're all the same. The Radak says, Anshe Midyanim heim Ishmaelim. And he goes a little bit further. If they're B'nai Keturah is really Hagar, and Hagar is really Ishmael's mother, so therefore they're all the same. Now, if that worked for you, great. But that's what the Radak just now said. 21 we don't need, but I just thought you'd enjoy it. It's Rav Avram ben Harambam, V'yavru'an Hashem, Amar Avi Abba. He's quoting Maimon. So if you've never heard Maimon being quoted before, that's why we're here. Shenekru b'nei Midyan Yishmaelim l'vishahim u'ravim b'hem. So he says the same thing, but a little differently. He says, no, they all live together. That Midyan and Yishmaelim, they ended up becoming one camp. Why? So again, I can make that other argument, because they have the common mother, father, and they therefore are the rejected children of Avraham, and they all live together. On the other hand, if we look at the Moshe of Canaan in source 22, and the truth is we're not, you know, in the middle of the story of Yosef, so we don't know how much we really want to read into this right now, but in source 22, it does raise the questions, and it realizes it's not so simple. So again, I'm not going to read more than necessary, but I really want to look at 23 and 25, and they essentially say the same thing. We'll look at Tolu Yitzchak, really the main thing. First he raises the whole problem. Then he says, V'yitachen l'faresha hamidanim hayu sar surim bein achi Yosef li'Yishmaelim. They became the middlemen, the brokers, who worked out the deal. Now, obviously, I don't know that much about business. Otherwise, I wouldn't be giving the shiur, would I? I'd be doing business. But sometimes in business, you have two sides who want to make a deal, and they can't work it out together. So you have a broker comes and sits in between them, and he actually will do a lot of the negotiating. He's going to help it to happen. If you look at, also in 25, the Orach Chaim says, Anashim midyanim socharim perish shemakirim kol min schora asher tizdamein luknota laharvacha v'teidaki asocher einu bal hakis elo bal hayidiya v'akero bal hakis yikne alpiv. So essentially what it's saying is that these people had nothing to do with the deal. They just, as Midyan does, got themselves stuck in the middle of this whole episode, which again, then we have to ask ourselves why, and my answer to why is because that's what Midyan does. And therefore, again, just following the same idea, Balak himself is not really the king. He's not the rightful heir. He's not the person who should be king. He got himself, he stuck himself into it. Why? Because that's what Midyan does. They come and they're talkers and they give advice and they tell everybody how to do everything better because they know everything. And they come in over here and they see that there is this potential for a sale. They're going to get a cut of the sale. And they find themselves in the middle of Mechirat Yosef, which, by the way, is not a great thing to do, as we'll see as we continue. And therefore, when I started the question, say, what in the world is this girl from Midyan doing in the middle of a Moab story? And the answer is, because it's Midyan. That's the answer. That's what Midyan does. Midyan finds themselves stuck in the middle of things that they're not supposed to be there, because that's who they are. So therefore, you know, when you see it one time, then it's doesn't tell you anything. You see it a second time, then maybe it says a little more. You see it a third time, or a fourth time, the question is how many times you want to see it. Because I also think we can now read something else that we're familiar with in a completely different way. And what is it that I'm referring to? Well, let's go a little bit further. First of all, when Moshe runs away, because he gets himself into trouble, he ends up in Midian. And what does this Kohen Midian? Now, we don't know what Kohen means. We don't know if Kohen Midian is a religious or is it a political appointment. Is he a leader, which is the way the Targum Onkelos seems to take us, or is he a religious functionary? And by the way, if he's a religious functionary, then again, let me say something which is annoying. You know, what exactly does he worship? Does he worship Baal? You know, being a Midian fellow, you know, what exactly is it that he worships as being a Kohen of Midian? Even though I will admit, before you catch me on this, that it was the Benot Moav who were the ones who brought Baal into the story. So, but nonetheless, what is it that a Kohen Midian does? Nonetheless, what he does is he gives his daughter over to a prince. Now, the reason why he's a prince, because Moshe is a prince of Egypt. But not only is he a prince of Egypt, later on he's going to become a king. And the reason why that's interesting is because there's just a direct echo of this when we started this week's parsha. When you do find a princess from Midian who is then caught together with a prince, a Rosh Av, a prince of the Jewish people, there is some type of a restatement of the story. Of course, there's obvious differences. The most important difference is that, well, let's put them in order. There's lots of differences. One is this is marriage, and that wasn't. Second is this is before Matan Torah, and that's not. I mean, we can keep on going from there, but the core of the story, one can argue, and there are midrashim that make that argument, where he says, hold it, you know, Ben Amram, if you're not allowed to marry somebody from Midian, and then how did you do it? But you realize that that chutzpah comes because of this, but it's much closer. That's really my point. It's much closer than you would have imagined. The next thing about Midian is that when we meet Yitro again, and now Yitro comes and he's in the middle. Now, again, Yitro is generally seen as a very favorable character, so I want to be careful. But he does come here and start giving advice and start telling us what to do and start telling us how to do things, which, as I say it again, always seems like a really good thing, unless it's not. It could be he was lucky here. It could be he was right over here. But it's still nonetheless somebody who has this ability of showing up in a place that they're not necessarily supposed to be and then tell people what it is that they're supposed to do, which is really, when you think about it, what it is that Balak did. Is he comes, he's a Midianite, he comes, and he uses this, again, I think the word I used before was catapult, to end up getting in a position of importance. Later on, we're going to find in Source 28, also where Reuel, assuming Reuel is the same, Chovev ben Reuel comes, and Moshe very much wants him to stay, and Moshe wants him to stay because he is going to, as far as Moshe is concerned, Pasuk Lamed Aleph, Al Na Tozev Otanu, Al Ken Yadat Chanotenu Bamidbar, meaning you know things that can help us. Again, you know how to give advice, you know how to get certain things done. But nonetheless, he said, Na Ki Im El Artzi Ve El Moladati Eilech. And now we do have to be a little bit more concerned when we realize that all the problems we've been running into has been because of Midian and Moav. But it's really Midian maybe has more to this than we imagined. Which takes us to future, Parashat Matot. Here, V'deber Hashem el Moshe l'mor, Nikom nikmat b'nei Yisrael me'eta Midianim. Where we're told God commands to take vengeance for the Jews against Midian. So, of course, you have to wonder why Midian? What did Midian do? Or what did Midian do that much worse? It's also noted that in Pasuk Gimel, Moshe says to the people, "Yo Midian, latet nikmat Hashem ba Midian," that he really wants to get vengeance for God, and God wants to get vengeance for the Jews, that there seems to be an affront against the Jews and affront against God, and the Midrashim very much go into this point. Rashi tells us something interesting. He gives us two different reasons why Midian is worse than Moab, because we really should be taking revenge against Moab. And he says, first of all, Shemoavim nechnasu l'davar machmat yira. They were afraid. They were next there. Midian also geographically comes from a much further place. Aval Midianim nit'abru al riv lo lahem. they got involved in something which wasn't there. I want to make that stronger now. It's not just that they got involved, that they were the instigators of something which wasn't theirs. Which means, again, if you keep in mind what Rashi himself had said, what we saw from the Targum Yonatan, that he, Balak, is not part of Moab. He's from Midian, and he now becomes this patriotic Moabite in order, let's take revenge against the Jews for taking our land. It wasn't your land, and why are you getting involved? This has nothing to do with you. There are other ways of dealing with this. And the other thing that Rashi throws at the end is, of course, that we need to... We need, you know, one other thing, and that is we still need Rut HaMoaviyah, which is interesting because that whole way it was framed before what had to do with Malchut, and of course we need Rut in order to have our Malchut, Beit David, to emerge. The various commentaries are going to try to figure out exactly in what way it was that Midian was worse, and we'll skip through. We have 31, which is the Mizrachiya commentary on Rashi. In 32, the Kli Yakar actually says, Be'etzatam, right? They gave the Etzah. They got involved. It had nothing to do with them. And nonetheless, they had to go and give advice. But it's interesting because he's also saying that Kihi Pilu Be'etzatam Isrim Ba'arba Elef Mi'Israel. It's saying that the idea of sending the girls down was actually the idea of Midian. Which means he's not spelling this out the way that I would prefer to spell this out. Let's look at this a little differently. There are two groups of girls there. There's this whole group, and then there's one. There's this whole group of girls from Moab, and then there is this woman or this princess from Midian. The princess from Midian, according to this, it's her. She's the one who is actually leading the charge. Why? Because she's from Midian. Why? Because she gets involved. It has nothing to do with her. Why? Because that's what Midian does. That's exactly my point. Nonetheless, even in this episode, because this is fascinating, the 24,000 people who were killed, I would have thought they're killed because of Benot Moab and because of the worshipping of Pa'or. And what we just now learned from the Kli Yakar is, and again, this is really what Rashi had said and what the Midrash is saying, that, yeah, but all that comes from Midian. They got involved in something that wasn't theirs. Now, I could have said that's only about the start of the war. That was about going and getting Bilaam and so on, and nothing to do with the end of the war. And again, I could have read the end of the war as a change in its strategy. It's at this point, let's befriend them. And nonetheless, it's reading it as saying, no, that this was done strategically or tactically. There's a tactic in order to try to kill as many as possible, and they know that their God is going to get upset with them for this kind of behavior, and therefore they send out the girls. But who is the one who's leading the way here? Because again, why do you have to say this? You don't have to, by the way, you can argue with me, but why do you have to say this nonetheless? It's because when the war comes, go to war against Midian, and it doesn't say go to war against Moab. And there's another element that I still want to get to. In Bamidbar Rabban source 33, it also not just an instigator, but it's again it's hamachti. Rabbi Shimon minayin shamachti et adam yoter min ahargo. The one who instigates is the one who's worse. And again, this is talking about our episode. In source 34 and 35 is the sources that tell us that it was Bilaam who then takes credit for this whole idea, and that's why he comes looking for his money, and that's why he shows up there, and that's why they end up killing him. But there's one more element that I want to get to today, and that is mentioned twice by Rashi. He mentions it in the beginning of this week's Parsha, in Parshat Pinchas, and he mentions it again in Parshat Matot. So let's look at it in 37. Pinchas ben Elazar, this is really where we began today. Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen. Is that the reason I have to come back here is to make believe that I spent all of the shiur on Parsha Pinchas. So yeah, the beginning and the end, so therefore, yeah. Magid Shehaya, sorry, Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen. Lefi Shehayu Ashvatim Mevazimoto. The other tribes were insulting him. They were humiliating him. Hari itim ben puti zeh shepitem avi imo agalib levoda zara varag nasi shevet b'Yisrael. Do you see this fellow whose grandfather, whose mother's father, was fattening up animals, calves, for idolatry, he went and killed a real Jew, which means essentially it's claiming that this fellow, Pinchas, does not have all that much Judaism to him. Therefore, it had to say, no, Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen. He has quite a deal of, a great deal of Judaism to him. Look at the way that Rashi says it in source number 38 in Matot. Otam v'et Pinchas, he also goes with them to battle. Magid she'a Pinchas shakul k'neged kulam. Otam v'et Pinchas, he's equal to all of them. Umanei ma halach Pinchas v'lo halach Elazar. Why does Pinchas go and not Elazar, who should be the Kohen Gadol? By the way, I'm not sure if that's a great answer. I could say the Kohen Gadol and the Kohen Meshuach Melchama are not the same. Nonetheless, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, mi she'etchil b'mitzvah she'rag kazbi batzur yigmar. Which again is telling us something interesting, because you say, no, the fact that Pinchas goes, it means the reason for this battle was not because of the whole episode with Bilaam, it's because of this. But this is fascinating. We're ignoring Moab, who sent all the girls down, and we're only focusing on one on Cosby, which is why I'm, again, arguing that they're the ones, that the end of the story with Cosby is the same as the beginning of the story with Balak. It's this person from Midian coming in and instigating to get involved where they shouldn't be involved. But then Rashi offers another issue, which is then going to take us full circle. Davar acher, shalach lenkom nikmat Yosef avi imo. He goes, really, no. And you're saying, hold it, how did Yosef get into this? It's saying, no, that his mother's father was Yosef. Shenemar v'middanib machru oto. Uminaim shaita imo shepinchas mishel Yosef. How do you know that's his genealogy? Shenemar mibnot pituel. Mizera Yitro Shepitem Agalim Levarazara. One approach, and it's in the Gemara right below us in 39 in Sota. He is from the word Pituel, is the one has Shepitem that fattened up the calves. Umizera Yosef Shepipit Bidyitro. But he's also from Yosef that was Pit Bidyitro, the one who knew how to talk down his Yitzhahara, calm down with Eshet Potiphar, and don't go there. So before I explain any more, I want to stay with Eshet Potiphar for a moment. What it's actually telling us is, where does Pinchas come from? And that's part of what the question was. Where does somebody like Pinchas come from? And what kind of chutzpah he killed? He killed a good, regular Jew. This must come from someplace else. So part of what Rashi just now told us is that, where does he come from to have this moral outrage towards the sexual sins that are taking place? So it's coming from the Yosef bloodline within him, because Yosef is the one who knows how to stand up against such temptation, and this is the Yosef which is within Pinchas. We now look at the Gemara that Rashi was quoting. Once you see the Gemara, you'll understand Rashi a little bit better. It says, again, Tana, lo lechinam halach Pinchas lemelchama. It wasn't for nothing, for naught, or no, for nothing. It wasn't for no reason that he goes. Eli paradin avi'imo, in order to take revenge. And again, now I want to point out, everything I was doing earlier, in order to show you that Midian keeps showing up in places they shouldn't show up, it's not just that that's what they do, it's linked together. Now you notice by the Gemara and by Rashi, it's linked together, because the stories are then linked together. This is not independent actions. It's the same action which now gets merged together, and now it's payback time for Midian getting involved where they shouldn't have gotten involved the first time. And it says, "Midian imachor to Mitzrayim lememra de Pinchas mi Yosef kati v'aktiv Elazar ben Aaron lakach lo mibnot pituel lo liisha lav mi Yitro." Doesn't he come from Yitro? Shepitem agalim vod kachavim lo mi Yosef shepit pet bi Yitro. So now it sounds like there's two opinions. V'lo shvatim mivazim oto. Right? We saw that in Rashi. They're making fun of him. Re'itim ben putizeh shepitem avi imo agalim vod azara. No, the reason they're attacking him, because essentially they're claiming he himself is an idolater. He's not a real Jew. He's coming from the Yitro line. Yarog nasim Yisrael, Eli'i, and the Gemara ends up saying no. Eli'i avua de'imei mi Yosef, either avua de'imei, either his mother's father is from Yosef, or ima de'ima mi Yitro, but his mother's mother is from Yitro. Ima de'ima mi Yosef, or his mother's mother is from Yosef, avu de'ima mi Yitro, and his father's mother. Essentially, what the Gemara is saying is, both of these opinions are true. Mi Yitro, daikana mi dichtiv, and notice it says, pituel, plural, tremashma, shmamina. It means both of them, and therefore he is both from Yosef and from Yitro. And over here, what he's doing is that he is now taking revenge. They're accusing him of not being it, but the Yosef issue, that's what I'm saying, I don't want you to ignore it. It also says, if you look at the Gur Aryeh, right, the Maharal explaining Rashi, Hadunakar HaShvatim Hayu Mevazim Matov. Hadunakar HaShvatim Hayu Abriyot Mevazim. It wasn't, no, it's as if they're claiming, oh, this is Yosef all over again. And it's at this point that I want to pause again, and then we'll get to one more point and finish. Who was actually the person, in at least in Chumash, who really was very good at getting involved and giving advice and being unbelievably good at giving advice? And the answer is, of course, Yosef. Which means, of course, you know, some of you already know the secret, that those times that I don't go back to Gan Eden, at least I go back to Yosef. Yosef is the one who is the real individual who knows how to give advice. And I'm not going to say the instigator, I'm not going to say get involved, but if you're talking about making, getting the deal done, somebody who's able to be there, who has this incredible insight, what I'm really getting at is that Midian is, in a certain sense, a cheap imitation of what Yosef is, and they there are the facilitators to get rid of Yosef, and Yosef then ends up being removed. And again, because they shouldn't be involved in this. When you realize, yeah, Yosef comes in and he gets appointed in charge of everything. That's what Balak did, which means Balak does a Yosef kind of move. He comes here and somehow catapults himself to a leadership position. Nothing to do with him, but Yosef actually does the same thing. So if you now think back for a moment, Moshe actually was quite tempted to keep Chovav with him. But at the end of the day, he ends up getting somebody else who is going to be the person who in this week's Parsha is going to be the one who is going to take Moshe's place. And of course, you know who that is, but I just want to make sure that we understand it properly. In Source 41, Moshe is told, you know, climb the mountain and you're not going to be continuing. And Moshe says, you know, God, you can't leave the people without someone, asher yetzei lefneihem v'asher yavo lefneihem, which is a really interesting turn of phrase. It's very similar to what the people complained when the eagle was ordered. It said, but we need somebody. So we need someone to replace. So at one point, some people thought it was going to be an eagle, which is quite remarkable. But God says that ultimately, no, who's the right person? The right person is Yehoshua. And Yehoshua, we know, of course, is from Yosef. And he's a person who has the capabilities of rising to the top and of becoming the leader and being this person who will be able to cross over the border and take the Jews into the land of Israel. And he's the one who you should be giving some of your abilities, power, prophecy, Shekhinah, that Moshe's been able to have, and give it over to Yeshua, who is, of course, from Yosef. So let me just recap to make sure. I don't know when I lost you along the way today. But there's a whole bunch of strands over here that I want you to notice. One of the strands is the Yosef strand, which is running all the way through and is the easiest one to miss and to lose. The other strand is this fascinating interaction between Moab and Midian, and you say, okay, what are they doing together? You know, what is this confederacy? And the answer is, it's really Moab has issues, but Midian is the instigator. Midian has nothing to do with any of this, but they're the ones who, you know, they pour oil on the fire, and they're the ones who are going to try to make this as dangerous of a situation as possible. And they get involved when they shouldn't be involved. And that's where we started today with Cozbi, for the Midianite. What is she doing over here? Well, don't be so surprised, because actually, if we moved back a little bit further, Balak did the same trick. He was from Midian, and then he gets involved, and he's the one who starts dragging all of Midian into all of this. If we go back, and drags all of Moab into all of this, we go back it a little earlier, we find at a very key stage, we find that these people normally can't get along with one another, but they end up coming together. But then we find that this other episode, which we all could have thought was just random, and that was by Mechirat Yosef, we find Midian stuck, you know, with their fingerprints all over the sale of Yosef. Going back to our Parsha, we find Pinchas, who is accused because of his connection to Yosef, and we're told, if anything, he needs to take revenge for Yosef, but that then becomes perfect. Of course, he needs to take revenge for Yosef, because it's Midian who had done the same thing in order to get rid of Yosef. And it's they had always tried to use other people's success in order to catapult themselves. And therefore, they get involved in things that they should not have anything to do with. And this follows all the way through. The possible collateral damage of what I've done today could be Yitro and how we now consider Yitro and how we should perhaps reconsider Yitro, or maybe not. As I said, I left many question marks. When Midyon comes, where's Yitro when Midyon comes? If he went back home, so where's he? Where's his children and grandchildren? Especially if you follow midrashically, they're looking for inside information about Moshe. Who's giving that inside information? Which means, do we have over here, at least midrashically, bringing us to Yitro's door and pointing an accusative finger and saying, you know, what went on over here? Why are Yitro's people, especially if he's some kind of a leader, you know, why is he not able to use that influence? Or did he use that influence in a negative way? And is he now working against us? When he tells us he's going home to his homeland, does he now become a patriot of his homeland? So I said, Yitro could be our possible collateral damage. And there are reasons to say that I'm completely wrong about this, including other psukim later on in Tanakh. I'm just throwing that out right now as a possibility. We don't know ultimately if the daughters of Moab went down there because somebody led them on. And again, I made that argument that this Midian led them on. The reason I made that argument is because that seems to be what the Midrashim are telling us, because otherwise it doesn't seem to make any sense. Why is Pinchas going out to war? Ah, he started, let him finish it. But that has to do with the girls, not having to do anything with the whole Bilam part of the episode. More than that, it's saying that that we're going to war against Midian because they're worse. What made them worse? One girl went down for Midian. No, it was their idea. They're the ones who instigated all of this, and they're the ones who gave advice. So once again, we find Midian involved in something they shouldn't be involved in. That's the reason we went back to look at all the other instances of this to help us understand this. And this, I do believe, is what Chazal are telling us. The other thing then that we got to understand is that once we linked the Yosef story with the Pinchas story, or the Cosby story, if you will, now you understand why going and getting revenge for Yosef becomes a part of the story, because you can't ignore that, because it is the same story being told over again. So I hope that I didn't confuse all of you more than necessary. It is necessary a little bit. But anyway, once again, those who need a refuah shlema should have a refuah shlema. And again, Mark, this should be le'ilui nishmas for your father. I hope he would have...